There we go. How's that sound?
Still muted. Good now. All right. Bumpy start there to get things started. All right. Cool. Well, welcome to Saber Sims Office Hours. Hit a little bit of a speed bump there, but my name is Jordan, head coach here at SaberSim, covering for Andrew here today. We've got a couple questions in our queue. We've got one question in our queue actually for today about lineup rules. So we'll get to that here in just a moment, but a good day to fire away questions into the YouTube chat, into the Discord server, the Office Hours channel. If you have questions, we've got a 13 game baseball slate on tap. So we could do some test builds here and just kind of see how things are looking, play around with the Sims. We did, as of this morning, release a brand new pro video into the Discord server. So if you are on SaberSim Pro or SaberSim Ultimate, you do get access to these special paywalled videos for that plan only. If you haven't seen them before, a lot of times it is me talking with somebody else on the team and really kind of going deeper into a particular sport or contest type or part of SaberSim or just some DFS theory stuff. If you've watched a lot of the videos on the YouTube channel and you want more content, especially stuff that's going a little bit deeper, more advanced stuff, those pro videos are really awesome to check out, a really cool perk of the pro and ultimate plan. So there is a new one in the Discord server as of this morning. Had the entire models team, as we call it internally here, which is Matt, Will, and Eric, on today to talk about baseball contest sims, really going deep into what's going on behind the scenes when you run them for your builds and for contest flashback, the biases and the limitations of the contest sim, things you should be looking for, ways in your process that you can kind of mitigate some of those biases or make your builds a little less fragile to them. So looks like we already have some folks in the chat here that watched it and enjoyed that video. So the goal of that going forward is to be getting one of those out monthly. So should expect a monthly pro or ultimate video. They're a lot of fun to record, a lot of fun to watch, or at least I hope they're fun to watch. So anyway, check that out if you haven't seen it already. But let's get to our question here that we have. And now we've got a few more in Discord already. So perfect there. Let's chat about this one here. This is from Astro Pepper. Get this pulled up on the screen. On tonight's DK Classic main slate, is there a way to build MME lineups but limit the number of players from 705 to 720 to occupy only 4 or 5 or 6 of the 10 required positions to leave some remaining spots open for late swap opportunities? So you certainly can do this. There's not really a good way to do it in an automated way. We don't have the game start time as an attribute for the players. We do have this for golf. So like for tee times, you can set up rules and say, guys need to tee off. You know, I want 4 guys teeing off before noon or something like that. Don't have a great way to do that for baseball. So you certainly can. Easiest thing to do would be to just add a grouping rule and say, you know, no more than 5. But from here, it is going to require you to go through and check the individual players that you want in this rule. So, you know, going through real quickly and adding each individual player, which is a little bit tedious, to be honest. I think, you could certainly get it done. You know, especially we'll have most of the starting lineups out, especially for those games before lock. That would be a decent way to do it. Another thing you could do is, trying to think this through here, you could say something like you only want to create stacks of the late games. I realize that's not exactly what you're looking for. I think either way, it's going to be a little bit of a manual process. The one other thing that came to mind here to me that you could do is you could export the player projections. So grab the CSV and then create a custom metric, basically, and maybe just put every player in a CSV here. I'll kind of just show you what this would actually look like rather than just trying to explain all this. Let's try it like this. So we can pull up, you know, this CSV and maybe just go just ID and team. And then
Whoops, that didn't have the effect that I wanted it to there. Let's see. Opponents.
And then, you know, something like, really, you could just call this whatever, like custom, and then say for players on the teams that you want to create this rule for, they could be, so I'll just do it for Cleveland, just as an example here. So filter by Cleveland. And say that this is one. And then filter by not Cleveland. And I don't even know if this is probably faster, but a little annoying. Filter by zero. But I'm curious to see if this actually even works. And you probably don't even need all the players. Actually, now that I'm thinking about this, this is literally every player in the player pool. This is probably a little bit overkill, but that's fine. You could just eliminate the players that didn't have a projection at all and then have a little bit of a smaller sheet. And now if we take this, and actually we could probably now also just delete this column so we don't re-upload team and then go back to SaberSim here. Let's see if this works. I've never actually even tried this. Okay, and now we call this a custom column, and we're just going to call it custom. Custom. Okay, and now if we make an automatic group and say use no more than five, say, where the requirement is custom is, I guess one and zero is a weird way to have done this. So let's just assume the group Cleveland in this case is representing the group of all the teams on this early game. So we're saying only five if they're equal to one, basically. And now if we create that group, let's see. Oops, did that do what we expected it to? It did. Okay. So that's actually probably the fastest way to do it, which is kind of weird. Because we don't have those game start times as an attribute you can use. So basically what we're doing is we're creating a custom metric for the game start time. And actually, now that I think about it, I wonder if, do we have game start times already in here? We don't. So we don't have game start times in here. That would be, I guess if they were in here, they'd be already available in the app. So that's kind of the idea. I actually think that's probably the best way to go about doing it. If you wanted to go that route, would be to basically create your own custom data column for something that represents the game start time, and then just make sure it's numerical, because the stat requirements are expecting a numerical greater than or less than. And then you can just say, you know, it could be any number you want, and then you can just create the group rule accordingly there. So let me know if that helps answer the question. I realize that's maybe a little bit confusing if you haven't done custom data or the lineup rules using stat requirements before. So let me know. This is a good question. And I see some questions coming in YouTube chat too. So we'll get to those in a second. I'm gonna get caught up on Discord here first. Does your process change on a massive MLB slate? I generally run one less max unique then it will give me with success. Yeah, I think min uniques is kind of a natural thing that would change. I would actually probably say that I'm a little bit inclined to use more min uniques rather than less, but that I don't think that's like a fact or like a law of larger slates that you must be doing that. That's just kind of by nature of the way that your lineups will get built. You'll have a little bit more flexibility to build lineups with more min uniques. What is going on here? There we go. Hang on. Let me refresh the app. I don't know why it's not taking my inputs there. There's more players in the player pool. So your lineups that you're getting out of the Sims are naturally going to be more diversified. So you're probably going to get more, you're probably going to have more diversification available to you when you go to diversify your lineups. My general process, if you've watched my videos walking through my baseball process on the YouTube channel, does not change dramatically with much bigger slates. I would say if you're playing, you know, maybe two game slates or something like that, maybe you can make an argument that you start to have a little bit of that showdown mentality start to come in, where you think about duplication a little bit more. Maybe you're intentionally leveraging ownership a little bit more. But also, at least for the most part in baseball, those two-game slates also come with much smaller contests, because they're turbos or afternoon contests where, you know, you're not getting 15,000, 25,000 lineups in those contests. They're like 2,000. So your risk of duplication is going down at the same rate the contest, the slate size is. Broadly speaking, I don't think my process changes dramatically for a very large slate. I'm trying to think about other things that I would think about. I would say on a larger slate, I am more conservative with weather risk, right? As there's more games on the slate. The way a lot of times I think about weather is like that, really, that you needing a player to be successful in DFS from a given game, that's a small percentage of likelihood, right? I'm conservative with weather already, because most of the time, I think there's a lot of different ways that the slate could go where you don't need those players from that game anyway. So you can just reduce some downside for free with being conservative with weather games. If there's 13 games on a slate, that's even more the case. There are even more lineups you can make that are profitable without that team. On a 4-game slate, it might be really hard to fade a game with really bad weather, for example. But anyway, let's close the loop on this here and run the contest sim and just play with min uniques here. Cause I would say I probably am likely to be a little more diversified with min uniques on a large slate. I've been settling in on most baseball slates this year being at around 4 min uniques. The way I have just arrived at that is I will run my build. I will run my contest sim. I'll filter out unprofitable lineups. And then I have found that most of the time, the one less than max number of min uniques, which is my general rule of thumb that I use here, is around 4. So I've just kind of stuck on 4. But I wouldn't surprise me if it's closer to 5 or 6 for a 13 game slate. So we'll sort by risk adjusted ROI and filter out the unprofitable lineups. So only show me lineups that have an ROI greater than 0. So a ton of lineups are coming through as profitable here, first of all. But if we bump up min uniques and try to find that artificial max here, so 7 is our max, right? Or 6 is our max. So 1 less than the max would be 5, which is a little bit more, which is higher, one min unique higher than I've been kind of as my standard through most of the season. So I would probably be a little bit more diversified in a 13 game slate for sure. Big picture wise, process doesn't change too much. I guess the one other thing, so I've talked a little bit before about how a lot of times I'll go in here when I get to this point in the build and maybe look for a few intentional fades of what I tend to do is I look for a few pitchers that are particularly chalky, that are up against good hitting teams and maybe have that low salary, like the chalky SP2 most of the time. A lot of times I want to attack that guy. If they're up against a good hitting team. So the guys that could potentially fit that today would be maybe Severino, maybe Soriano here, up against pretty decent teams, low salary guys that I think are going to be chalkier. But on a 13 game slate, they're not going to be as chalky. And sometimes you don't even need to do that as much, right? The negative leverage factor isn't as important there. So that would actually be one other thing where on a bigger slate, I'm probably less likely to try to go find game theory angles to play and instead trust the sims a little bit more. Whereas on a seven game slate, I'm probably a little bit more likely to try to do that. So good question though. And then for single entry, would you run just one lineup or several? I think it kind of depends on what you mean here. So I think there's a couple ways for me to answer this. The first is when I think about single entry contests, a lot of times it's a part of a larger portfolio of lineups I'm playing on the slate. So, and this is kind of DFS profit plan, our contest selection guide, right? We'll have you generally playing a mix of a bunch of different single entries along with 20 max and 150 max, and then filling them all with unique lineups. So if you're referring to, I would not recommend playing the same lineup in multiple single entry contests. You're really just increasing your variance and just doubling down on that lineup where you can you'll realize profit a little more reliably by spreading out and playing unique lineups into each of those. So I would certainly recommend that. In terms of actual like process for building single entry lineups, I do have a really helpful video on the YouTube channel that is a good place to get started with this. It's a new one here. So in the How to Beat MLB DFS in 2024, this five-step process to building profitable MLB DFS lineups, this is basically like a how should you build one good lineup video. So if you're playing a high-stake single entry or you want a ticket or something like that, or even if you're playing like a qualifier and you just, this is how I would recommend building a single good lineup on SaberSim. If you particularly wanted to make sure one good lineup from your build ended up in a particular contest, this is how I'd recommend doing it. So I'd watch this. This is a really helpful video, but bigger picture, a lot of times when I'm thinking about my single entry contests in my lineup portfolio, they're a part of the bigger picture and they're fitting in here to the rest of the build. So if I was playing, you know, let's say this was my actual pool and I was playing, say, the mini max and the $1 20 max and a bunch of single entries, and maybe I had like 195 total entries, I would probably be doing something a little bit more like this. Maybe min uniques is coming down in that case, and just filling these uniformly, filling these uniquely into my file from there. That's how I would approach it, because I'm thinking about my contest portfolio rather than particular contests that I'm targeting particular strategies for. Is more just like, I like the structure and the portfolio of my entries I have as a whole. Here are 194 diversified lineups that I can play that I like for them. So. Okay, let's get back up onto the top of the YouTube chat here. Chuck says, I had an idea to take the highest and lowest sim ROI lineups from Flashback and sim those lineups in the pre-contest sims. What are your thoughts on this approach? I usually notice 40%+. I think I lost a message here, because the next one I see from you, Chuck, says 40%+ ROIs would be a good guardrail. I think I get what you're saying. So you're basically saying like taking lineups in Flashback and seeing how did your best lineup in Flashback, how would it have simmed pre-lock, or how did it sim pre-lock? Then what was your worst performing lineup in Flashback, and how did it sim in, how would it have simmed pre-lock? So yeah, this is interesting. And I will say, going back to the pro video I had talked about at the start of the stream, this kind of stuff, the biases of why is a lineup that grades out well pre-lock coming back negative post-lock, how can we mitigate that? That is the kind of stuff we talked about in that almost that entire pro video from this morning. So if you're interested in this, this is definitely more kind of advanced stuff. I would check that out. In terms of this process, I mean, I think there's a couple things going on here. One, if you set a higher projection floor or a higher ROI floor of say 40%, for example, like you are going to, I think you are going to be directionally more accurate in making sure your contest Flashback sim ROIs are higher, because you're just raising the bar of what those lineups have to do, right? Like if your worst lineup that you're playing is a 40% ROI lineup instead of a 5% ROI lineup, then we have to be wrong on the ROI lineup by a lot more for the 40% lineup for it to come back as negative in the post contest Flashback. So I think there is something to be said for that. On the flip side of that, that's going to reduce the number of lineups you have in your pool. So it's going to reduce the ability to diversify with min uniques to some extent. It's also going to reduce your ability to take individual stands with your portfolio, right? You're essentially getting closer and closer to what we believe is optimal in the game simulations, but you might disagree with that, right? There might be a lineup that is shown as a 30% ROI in your build that, because of negative leverage that you're getting on by stacking up a team against a pitcher that you think is going to be popular, like something I would want to do, you don't have access to that lineup anymore because you've eliminated it with this more rigid pre-lock rule. The other thing to keep in mind there is, and we talked about this in the pro video too as well, is sometimes the reason that a lineup, it's not always true that it is just the worst lineups in your portfolio become the negative ROI lineups in contest flashback, right? Like if it's not completely linear in that way. And if it was, it would be a lot easier to solve this problem, right? If it was just like the lineups below 50% ROI are always at risk of becoming negative ROI in post-contest flashback. So we set a floor there and then all of our lineups are always profitable. It doesn't always work that way. There are assumptions that are kind of baked in, and there's variance and noise baked into both the game simulations and the field lineups that can come through at any lineup in your pool. Now, lineups with a higher sim ROI are a little bit less likely for that. But for example, we're seeing a lot of A's lineups here as our highest ROI lineups in our pool. And it may not take much extra ownership on the A's for these lineups to quickly become unprofitable, even though they're the top lineups. And in setting a more rigid projection floor and reducing our ability to get higher min uniques, we actually might even get more concentrated on the A's. So one of the conclusions we came to in the video, and again, I'd really recommend checking it out because it goes a lot more into depth, and the models team is a lot more articulate with talking through some of the stuff than I am at times here. What I would be thinking about is to try to create a portfolio of lineups that is resistant, that is anti-fragile to being wrong about anything on the slate, right? Because you know that certain things are going to be wrong, especially as it relates to the field lineups. Even in a theoretically perfect ownership model that like had no other biases, there's just enough randomness in what lineups actually get played that it's going to affect the way that lineups grade out. And your goal curating your portfolio should be to try to make it resistant to those where possible. And I think Min Uniques is just a great tool, period, to do that already, because it's going to reduce the amount of risk. You know, if we look here, the drop that we get from Oakland going from 45% to 4% to, let's go back to 5, to 22% already makes us a lot more resistant to fragility in the ownership projection of the A's, while still getting over the field on them. But there's other things you can do there too. So anyway, good question. And definitely stuff that we go into a lot more in that pro video. So I checked that out. Do you have a min salary that you typically run when finding lineups to build, or do you run the defaults regardless of sport or showdown slate? Yeah, this is super interesting. And it kind of depends. This is one of the things I've been looking at. I've been using flashback quite a bit, especially to look at salaries. And especially just because it's a very easy thing to see quickly. So let me pull something up here and we'll kind of talk about this. But I think the defaults are fine. And I think this is an incremental improvement. I'll start by saying that. I don't think bumping up your min salary by 500 or dropping it down a little bit in certain sports is like the skeleton key. But I do think there's something to learn here when looking at salary allocation for different slates. So this is a 7-game slate from the other day, so not exactly the same thing. But I have found, for the most part, amongst top 150 maxers in these contests, for baseball, salary is getting pretty well close to maxed out. I've noticed that throughout this season. And a lot of times I would actually even go even further to say in sports where duplication is not a significant concern, I have found that the salaries allocated by the top 150 maxers are pretty high. I have played with a salary max of 49.5 in baseball this season, and I have liked it, for lack of a better word. I don't have like a lot of quantitative evidence to say it makes you that much better, but I like building lineups with higher salaries in general for baseball. And I found that to work pretty good. Now on the flip side, for showdowns and dupe sports, it's a very different story, and it really depends on the sport. I did a ton of investigation in NFL last year into NFL showdown to study how some of the top players were using salary to avoid dupes in different types of NFL games, and found that the average salary used by top players for NFL Showdown seemed very correlated to the total of the game, that the lower the total of the game got, the more salary was left on the table by top players, and the lower their dupes got, and the higher the total of the game was for the NFL Showdown game, the more salary they were comfortable. And this is assuming a large field 150 max tournament on a primetime game, not so much all the showdowns during the Sunday slate, but the higher the total was, the more salary players used while still keeping their dupes down. And that kind of checks out intuitively, as like a game has a higher total, there are a wider spectrum of players that have upside to get to a game to have a 52 point total. A lot of players are going to have to score. Some of them are low salary. Some of those are there's just a wider variety of players in a low total game. The point scoring is very concentrated, right? There's only a few players. Like it's harder to build lineups that are unduplicated while using max salary. In NHL Showdown, which I actually have a video coming out most likely next week, right before the Stanley Cup Finals starts, just to give you guys some content right to the edge of the NHL playoffs here. One of my tips actually in that video is to set your minimum salary higher than the default is, because with how small these contests tend to be for NHL Showdown and how big the player pool is of usable players, you really don't need to take a lot of risk to avoid duplication in these contests. And you can afford to increase the quality of your pool a little bit higher. So I think that's kind of the way I think about it, is a lot of times I want to be bringing my min salary down and even my max salary down on sports where I'm really duplication focused. And I'm trying to intentionally play lineups that I think other players are not going to play. Whereas in sports where that's not as much of a concern, I want to bump that up, mostly just to increase the floor of the worst possible lineup in my pool. I think that's probably the really, especially as it relates to baseball, like we don't need to spend too much time today talking about NFL Showdown in the on the last day of May here, right? For baseball, for main slates, the value that you get out of slightly increasing that is you're just making the worst lineup in your pool probably a little bit better. And while 5,000 lineups is a lot, it's not even close to all of the lineups that are possible, or even all the lineups that are good that are possible. So increasing that floor of that min salary, I think, can be a little bit helpful. But it's set at 49,000 already. So we're really talking about a small difference here. Like the idea that a lineup at 49,000 salary is not good and a lineup at 49,005 is good is probably not true. But I have noticed that those top 150 maxers are using a lot of salary, and I've made that adjustment here a little bit this year. So I find myself constantly dropping it for MLB to like 45K only because I wasn't sure which way it'd be affected. I thought I'd have a limited player pool by using a higher total. Yeah, I think it's mostly like, it's not to say that a lineup at even 47.5 in baseball is not viable. Right. If you wanted to go on this slate and play, like, I don't know the salaries exactly, but I'm assuming Oakland probably has low salaries, and presumably that maybe Washington has low salaries. Right. Here, we could probably just look at the value and kind of intuit this pretty quickly. Or if you wanted to do a White Sox A stack, right, it might be literally impossible to build that combination of teams with a salary floor set high. So, and that lineup is perfectly viable. Right? Those teams are going to have upside. They can have upside together on the same slate. I just think, I don't know if you need to do it. And I don't know if I want spots of my lineup pool occupied by those teams. Like, I think those teams are maybe a little bit less likely to sim well in contest sim anyway, and then you are just trashing them. So this is another good example, going back to the question from before too, of maybe on a larger slate, maybe you're a little more willing to do this. And you'll notice that is already how the min salary defaults work. They will, especially on small MLB slates, will start to drop. That's kind of why. But for a large slate, I don't know if it's needed. So Jay said, how can we add more of a player's minutes? So you don't have a good way to do that in a direct way. There's no way to say, hey, this guy's projected for 28 minutes. Bump them up to 32 and kind of re-sim the game. The easiest way to do what happens in practice, if you were to do that, is to just bump up the player projection by the correct value. So if we go back to last night here, what I've done in the past is just quickly get a points per minute idea. So maybe you thought Naz Reid was going to play more last night. So we have him projected for 22.3 points at 24.25 minutes. So that is, he has in our Sims, he has 0.92 fantasy points per minute in this sim. So if you think that he should get an extra 3 minutes or something like that, you're increasing his projection by 2.75. So I'm doing some of this off screen on the calculator app, but like you can kind of follow. So really we're saying Naz Reid's projection should be 25 in this case. And you've essentially increased his minutes projection. Now those 3 minutes need to come from somewhere. I think at this point, it depends a little bit on how extreme your minutes projections are. One thing that I've done is, you know, you can kind of just eyeball where you think those minutes are going to come from, depending on who the player is. So maybe in this case, like really what we're saying is we think, you know, Towns and Gobert are going to play a minute less a piece, and maybe Kyle Anderson plays a minute less, something like that. And so you're bringing these guys down. The bigger the original adjustment, the more you probably want to be cognizant of the effect of that, right? If you're bumping up a player by 3 fantasy points, that's probably within the range of error of this player's projection anyway. So, you know, maybe not needed too much. But if you thought the rotations, especially in like regular season NBA, if you think a player's minutes projection is off by like 15 minutes, like somebody gets hurt, it's the first time they've been hurt all year. We don't know who the backup is really going to be. And there's a lot of variance in that situation. And you think the backup that is simmed is just like not the actual guy that's going to start and soak up most of that minutes. You would obviously want to account for that by reducing some other players. Otherwise, you're going to have minutes projections that add up to 260 minutes or something like that. But this is a simple way of kind of doing this here. And adding that to your process. So 5 uniques for 13 games. I mean, so again, it's not. I mean, sure, that probably is not going to lead you astray. I don't really generalize that way. What I like to do with my lineups is I will run the build, get back here, and filter out lineups that are unprofitable in the contest sim. So I have basically my pool of 4680 lineups here. And then what I do is I look to see how high can I put min uniques before I stop getting the number of lineups I need. So if this was for a 150 max contest, if I go to 7, all of a sudden I'm only getting 146 lineups back. That's not enough. If I go to 6 will give me 150. That is the maximum. I like to leave my min uniques at 1 or 2 less than that max. It kind of depends on the slate and how many other changes I'm making to my exposures. But so I'd be probably in the 4 or 5 range here for this slate. So if you just took away from that and said, okay, 4 to 5 min uniques for every MLB slate, you actually would probably get pretty close to other people that were following this step for step. But it is kind of important, I think, to note why that number is what it is and where it comes from, rather than just writing it down on a piece of paper and saying Jordan said 5 min uniques. Because then it lets you do the same process for other sports and things like that. This is the same process that I use for navigating min uniques most of the time. So Jay says, should we cap hitters at 65% to not get garbage guys? Honestly, apart from very small slates, you probably won't even ever see a pitcher hitter at 65% period with this approach. It's pretty hard to get that high. Maybe on like a Dodgers at Coors type slate. But at that point, those guys are going to be so high owned, you have to have really high ownership. You have to have really high exposure to get over the field on them anyway, if that's what the contest sims want you to do. So, I don't end up doing a lot of manual capping of hitters because it doesn't seem to be a problem in my builds. I rarely am like getting out of control exposure on any given hitter for the most part. Like I'm totally fine with, I mean, some of these A's guys being at 25-ish%. That's probably fine with me. So, but if you get to this point in the process and you have built your lineups, run the sim, filtered, diversified, and you're looking at some of these guys and like especially looking at the leverage column and thinking, man, do I need 15 percentage points of leverage on the Oakland A's today? And your answer is no. Like, you can certainly set max exposures here and bring some of this down. Even sometimes just setting a max exposure to one of them will have the effect of bringing a bunch of them down because they're correlated in your lineups. So you can see like immediately that has smoothed out our leverage. And that's a good use of your time here at this point in the process to look at your top leverage hitters, look at your negative leverage hitters, your pitchers too, and, you know, make a decision if you're comfortable with the stands that you're taking in your lineups, the associated risk, and so on there. So Pope says, what is your post-lock late swap looks like? Should we run a late swap before the start of the next game by ROI? Do we change anything else? Thank you. Yeah. This is always, this is kind of a tricky one for baseball. I think first, if your goal was to strictly do everything optimally, so you're basically, you are basically trying to maximize your expected value of every lineup at every point, I think it is probably best practice to run a new late swap build before the start of every game, re-contest sim it using the live sims, right? Using the live data about what opponents are in your contests and what has happened in the games that have already started. That is probably best practice from purely maximizing EV. In reality, it's a long summer with a lot of baseball games. I can't say that I do that every single time I play MLB DFS. For a slate like tonight, I might, you know, keep an eye on things, like put things in at lock, let it ride all the way to maybe, you know, 5:45-ish, kind of see how things are looking. It, certainly you want to keep an eye on the news, right? If a player gets scratched or a lineup changes or a lineup comes out in the late games, that's something we need a late swap for, period, right? But maybe see how things are kind of looking at 6:10. I have a tendency on nights where it looks like I'm doing pretty well, right, to maybe be a little more diligent with those in-between game swaps. Because if I have a lineup that, you know, maybe it's the A's stack, right? Maybe the A's go off and all of a sudden it's like, oh, you know, they have seven runs through three innings or something like that. And it's like, hey, I had a lot of A's. Now I might be a little more diligent with coming back before these 6:10 games lock, rerunning that swap and re-optimizing for ROI, because now I really want to maximize my shot there, right? Maybe some of those A stacks had, I don't know, there's a lot of different things. Maybe some of those A stacks were also paired with a lot of Dodgers or something like that. And the initial field lineups that we're getting show that, you know, people used a lot less salary than we expected. So all of a sudden the Dodgers ownership projections have gone up and it's maybe those lineups are now going to be competing with a lot more Dodgers. So long story short, like, If you are seeking maximum EV on every single lineup you play in every contest, the best thing you should be doing is rerunning a swap before the start of each game to capture the live sims and the live field lineups that are coming in, at least on DraftKings. On FanDuel, we don't have that same live data, but on DraftKings, we do. In practice, you know, a lot of times you're talking about pennies on the dollar of EV for those, unless there was significant news or... so it's a long summer, a lot of slates. I think if you instead took an approach of saying, I'm going to swap when a player gets scratched or a lineup changes, you would probably be fine. And you're probably only adding a little bit of value there, but yeah, for maximizing EV, that would be best practice. Another way you can kind of do it is a lot of times, like, and I think a lot of people do this, say after the 5:10 games lock, say we've got six games on this slate locked, I'll go through and poke through my lineups and just look at ownership projections and see. And you can get kind of a sense of like who was going to be chalky ahead of time. And if you're looking and it's like, Toronto's a good example because it's an early team, right? We think Toronto's going to be pretty popular here. And if you're going through and you're looking at your Toronto lineups and it's like, hey, wait, nobody played these guys. Toronto's way lower owned than expected. That actually might be a good signal to you that you do want to be more intentional about getting a swap in before at least maybe the 6:10 game, but maybe even this A's game, because suddenly you've got this team that in your original lineups, we built this team assuming they were going to be chalky and built teams accordingly based on that. But now they're not. So now we can swap in the remaining players around them. And that could be something you do a little bit more qualitatively, where you're checking the field lineups against the ownership projections earlier on and just seeing, does anything really jump out to you? Or maybe it's a pitcher, right? Maybe nobody played Tanner Beebe, right? Like he's comes in at 12% owned, and that kind of stuff doesn't happen all the time. At least, I don't think so, where there's dramatic changes in ownerships, but maybe he's way lower owned than expected. And all of a sudden you can be swapping some of those BB lineups that you played into Dodger stacks because you're getting leverage on the pitcher spot in a way that the original contest sim didn't think you did. So this question is written, what does your post-lock late swap look like? So in full disclosure, most of the time when I'm playing, I will check in. One, I have the notifications turned on, and I'll kind of keep an eye on things and really look out for a player getting scratched that's in my lineups. If I have that player, I'm running the quick swap to get them out of my lineups, and then I'm running a late swap to rebuild. And then apart from that, a lot of times I'll just keep an eye on how my lineups are doing throughout the slate. And if it looks like I've got something going and a lineup that looks like it has a shot, I'll be a little more intentional about getting swaps in for the last couple blocks. But as a wearing the DFS coach hat, if you are maximizing EV in every single lineup, you should be swapping before the start of every game, at least on DraftKings. So another good question there. Cool. What else we got? 104 of you hanging out with me here today on this Friday afternoon. Appreciate you joining the stream. I'm sure many of you guys listening along, watching along here, maybe while you're finishing out the workday. So appreciate people hanging out. Any other questions for me today? I believe Andrew will be back tomorrow for the Saturday morning show. We do one at 11 o'clock Eastern on Saturday mornings. It's kind of especially an opportunity for people that don't have the opportunity to see these shows live during the week at all. Saturday morning show is a really good one to tune into there. So yeah, fire away. Jay says, how do you late swap if a player's scratched? Okay, yeah, so we can kind of demo this here. Let me real quick. I'm not going to be able to play this slate at full volume today, but I will show you with a real entries file for tonight so we can actually kind of demo this. Let's do the quarter. Just so we have an entries file to use here. Unless I get location checked on DraftKings. Nope. Okay. So we've got our entries file in here. And let's go back to this build here and say that we're playing 20 lineups. And we fill this and we download. And then here, we'll go ahead and upload it too. Okay, so these are our lineups. Okay, so now it is post-lock, right? So now it's after-lock. So what we want to do, and let's see. So first of all, let's say Brewer's pitcher gets scratched. Wait, that's not what I wanted to do. Let's say Brewer's pitcher goes to zero. Projection, right? Essentially gets scratched. First thing you're going to see is this red lightning bolt go red. You'll also get a notification here. And if you are allowing, like first, you want to make sure you're allowing these notifications, right? First, but if you've allowed browser notifications, you'll get a notification from SaberSim in your browser saying, hey, this player's out. So first thing that you should always do in that case is get them out of your lineups using the quick swap. So the quick swap will basically put in the best possible projected player in a game who has not started yet into that spot in your lineups. And if it's a hitter that got scratched, one thing you can do is first do best swap best available from the same team and put in a different hitter on that team into as many spots as possible to maintain the stack that that player probably is a part of, and then swap the remaining with best available. But when you do this, so in this case, it's saying, okay, we got Tobias I almost said Tobias Harris. You got Tobias Myers out of your lineup. We put in Jose Soriano into one. Now we can download this, re-upload to DraftKings. That's like your panic button. Get this guy out of my lineups. And really, you should just be doing that all the time, even if you have time to late swap, right? Then what I would recommend doing when it actually comes time to late swap the lineups is clicking this button and initiating a late swap. So what this is going to say, this is going to say first, what contest do you want to late swap? And then this down here is, do you want to take the build settings you were using from the original build in your swap? So like if we do clone current build settings, this would take the build settings that are used in this build three, any exposures we had set, anything like that, and take it over into the late swap. There's not really like, I can't tell you this, like you should do this one way or the other. You should just be aware, like if you do use defaults, you're going to lose custom exposures you set before. If you use clone current build settings, you're going to keep those exposures, but that might also make it harder to swap, or it might swap in a way you no longer want to do, right? So let's say you had a bunch of min exposures for Dodgers stacks, and then the Dodgers lineup comes out and a bunch of guys are resting tonight, right? It's a terrible Dodgers lineup. Well, if you cloned your current build settings, maybe you're still forcing 40% Dodger stacks, right? So just be aware of that. I tend to typically go back to use defaults, but that's often because also I'm not making a lot of individual changes to my builds. So I just want the late swap to work as cleanly as possible. So you go to late swap one contest. This is going to create a new build now for you. Looks very similar to how it does pre-lock. The only difference here is you can't change the number of lineups that you are swapping, and you can't directly change the number of lineups you're building. It's instead going to ask you how many times do you want to swap each lineup. I generally max this out. So I'll just enter 5,000 into this field, and it will just find the maximum number where pool size doesn't exceed 5,000. One thing to keep in mind here, if you're only playing a handful of lineups, it won't always actually achieve this number. Sometimes it will kind of, like if you were playing three lineups, it isn't necessarily going to be able to find it isn't necessarily going to be able to find like 1,300 valid swap options for each original lineup you played, but you just want this number as big as possible. Then you rebuild, and now this is going to rebuild the best possible lineups around all the players who have already locked. In this case, in this example, the slate hasn't started, so it's not really going to do anything. This is exactly the same as building pre-lock, actually, at this point. Nothing is different here, but let's say this is at, you know, six o'clock my time. This would have all of the players in the earlier games locked, all of the players in the later games unlocked. So it takes a minute to run. And then you want to run, this very similar to exactly what you do pre-lock. You want to run your contest sim. Only this time, your contest sim is not just using the pre-lock game simulations. It is using the post-lock game simulations. So for all the games that are in progress, let's say it is currently 3-1 Mets in this game. All of the game simulations that we're using for that game when you run your contest sim are not assuming the full range of possible outcomes anymore. They're assuming what is the possible range of outcomes now that the score is 3-1 from this point, right? And if you came back to at 8 o'clock and some of these early games had already finished, they're going to have no range of outcomes. The fantasy point for a player that they scored in the game that ended is just what they scored. In addition to that, it's also pulling in the real lineups your opponents are playing in your contest. So your contest sim now, when you run for the quarter jukebox, for example, is not looking at what do we expect the field to look like on average. It is literally what lineups do we know are already in this contest and what are the most likely options that those lineups of the players we don't know in those lineups could be. So you're progressively, and this is kind of why, to the previous question of like, should you late swap before the start of every game? My answer was theoretically yes, because all of this stuff adds up to getting a better idea of what the most profitable way is to play the remainder of the slate. So if we run this contest sim now, right? This time it would run with a knowledge of what players are actually in lineups in all these early games. How are those games going, right? How have they started, right? If your A's have zero runs through the bottom of the fourth inning or something like that, all the A's stacks are going to start looking a lot worse. So now you can rebuild those lineups to try to salvage as much equity as possible. So anyway, you run the contest sim, sort by risk-adjusted ROI, and now you could re-enter these lineups. Save, save, download, re-upload to DraftKings. So. All-star DFS says, if a lineup has a positive ROI but is duped 100 times, as an extreme example, that is technically still a good lineup to play. Do you think heuristics like under five dupes are made up or are they valid? So if you had, as a hypothetical, if you had a perfect field, so you knew exactly what lineups your opponents were going to play, and you also had a perfect game simulation, so you knew there was no biases in your game simulation. You could come up with all the possible game scripts of the way that the game could play out. And you ran a contest sim on that, and you had a lineup that was duped 100 times, and it was showing a profitable ROI. That lineup would be profitable. And if it was the best possible lineup in your pool, it would be the best lineup you could play. That would be solved. That is just true. Right? So, like, that... Sorry, my dog's barking. It distracted me here. That the dupes are kind of a descriptive way of identifying if a lineup is likely to be profitable, because as a lineup gets duped, what it wins when it wins goes lower and lower. But it is not necessarily a statement of fact that any lineup that is duped is unprofitable, or that any lineup that is duped more than another lineup is less profitable than said lineup, right? So you will see, and this, I think a really good example of this is NBA Showdown, where with a more limited player pool, especially in the playoffs with massive contests, right, there are plenty of lineups that are duped, sometimes quite a bit, that actually grade out as profitable. And that's just because, like, you can't just build lineups of a bunch of bench guys that are, like, almost have no chance of making it into the game and have a lineup that's ever going to win or score enough points to win. So if you look and go look and see what the top 150 maxers are doing here, which is often what I like to do for these, you'll see average dupes 25 here. I think this is Osimo. I was looking at this earlier. So Osimo got down to five dupes and left a little salary on the table. This is actually, like, speaking of contest flashback, I would actually be pretty interested to go in and look at his lineups and see, like, what did he do here? Because being the third highest sim ROI 150 maxer, 3.0% average sim rate, and having an average dupes of five or less with 37 uniques, like, that's actually pretty impressive, I think. But you'll see a lot of these people, right? This is a good example too. 64 average dupes, average sim ROI of 80.7%, right? And that's because in NBA, a lot of times, like, the opportunity cost of sacrificing projection or salary to lower your dupes is too high. You don't win often enough with unique lineups for it to pay off lineups that win more often but share winnings when they win. An NFL Showdown, on the flip side, is the opposite. You lineups that are much less likely to be duped win often enough to pay off to pay off that sacrifice. I feel like I'm not explaining that particular point really well, right? Like, another way of thinking about this is lineups that are duplicated or duplicated more are often more likely to be the winning lineup, because players are using projections and tools that generally give you a good sense of direction of, like, what lineups are likely to score more on average. Lineups that are more unique or less duplicated are less likely to be the winning lineup, because a lot of times you are sacrificing average expectation to get there in the form of salary or projected score. But it is sport dependent and contest dependent and even slate dependent where the trade-offs actually line up. Is it worth it sacrificing average expectation to lower your dupes? Does the lineup projected to do worse on average get there often enough to achieve a positive ROI or not? And in NFL Showdown, that the answer is it often does, because players can get 99th percentile upside on a single play. In NBA, it often doesn't, because there aren't any players that can get 99th percentile upside on a given play. So you have to play players that are projected well on average. So. I think we kind of went in a circle a little bit there. But it is a good, and that this is just a good question when you're kind of thinking about DFS in general, because there's a lot of things like this where dupes is a measure to describe a thing that we know is generally true. And that is, the more a lineup is duplicated, the lower its EV gets, right? Like, if you could play a lineup and it's unique, and the lineup is static and it's unique, that's going to be a higher EV than if it was duped five times, right? And we kind of broadly know generally that it is true that we want less duplicated lineups in sports where that's something we need to think about. But dupes itself is just a descriptive characteristic that kind of helps us get there directionally. And it's not a statement of fact that it needs to be a certain number for your lineups to be profitable in any given slate. The reason I think this is like interesting to think about just broadly is you hear similar things with ownership, or stack types is another common one, right? QB plus two with one run back, right? That gets tossed around as a rule of NFL DFS because that is an easy, simple rule to program into an optimizer that has no other basis for what correlations are. Capping your maximum ownership at 125% is a simple rule that could be programmed into an optimizer because it has no other knowledge about how ownership should be navigated on a slate. In practice, when you can use something like a contest sim to solve those more directly, the rules of thumb kind of fall apart a little bit. So, if you're always playing a unique lineup, then it's probably too unique, because if the lineup is actually that good, eventually others would start playing it, if that makes sense. Yeah. And so the other thing, and there's a rabbit hole that you can go down here. I think this is a really interesting part of strategy, is lineups that are profitable when they are unique are a lot more fragile have a lot more fragile expected ROIs, right? So a lineup, like if you take, let's say you have a lineup that, and this is really interesting. Let's say you have a lineup that you're expecting to be duped 10 times, and you have a lineup that is expected to be unique, and those lineups have the exact same ROI. I would always rather play the lineup that is expected to be duped 10 times, because if you are wrong on that number, it is going to be less damaging to that lineup's expected ROI. If it comes in duped 12 or 13 or 14 times, its ROI is going to drop, but that lineup was already simmed assuming it was going to be duped some of the time. And it also has upside there. If people just suddenly decide they're not going to play that lineup a little bit, maybe that lineup comes in five times, your ROI is actually going up. But that unique lineup, expected to be unique, if it was even duped just once, sometimes that just craters the EV. Like, the only reason that lineup was, you'll notice this especially in NFL showdown with extremely top heavy GPPs, like Millimaker, Monday Night Footballs, things like that. But like, a lineup that is unique and is expected to be unique can have a very high ROI because it wins everything when it wins. But if it gets duped once, its EV is cratered. It goes down significantly. So yeah, it is interesting. And this is true as well. The point you're making here, like, I don't think it's not as if a unique lineup is just automatically bad, because why did nobody else play it? But lineups that appear to be unique by sim tools like SaberSim or any of our competitors or anything like that are increasingly not going to be unique because other people are going to find them. And that's something we're aware of. And that is a very tricky positive feedback loop to kind of solve for, right? Because the input affects the output. What we say, if we say a lineup is going to be unique and it's positive EV, well, and it is only plus EV because it is expected to be unique, well, now it doesn't take many people to ruin that lineup. So really interesting. I think showdowns and heavy duplication sports are some of the most interesting DFS game types at the moment to play and think about, especially in the 2024 DFS ecosystem. Like, they're really, and I'm really excited for this year of NFL Showdown for that reason, because I think it's going to be a really fun, I just think it's going to be a fun game state.
Like the games have certainly gotten a little bit tougher. NFL Showdown, maybe less so. There'll be a lot of casual and recreational money coming in there. But like, it will be interesting to play NFL Showdown now that people, you know, it's basically a year of sim tools being around. And I think people, a year of contest sim tools being publicly available, including ours. And I think people have really gotten comfortable with them. And a lot of people have, at least people that are deep in this space, have a good understanding of how they work and what they're doing. And it will be interesting to see how people play the dupe game this year. And NFL is interesting too, because the contests are enormous. So your, maybe there's lineups that are going to be duped 500 times, 1,000 times, probably on opening night. So it's really fun. And that's not to say that that main slates are not fun either. They are, but I think there is less to kind of think about there personally, in terms of like what you're solving for. So, but yeah, the showdowns and the dupe sports are a lot of fun. MMA is also a blast for a similar reason. So yeah, All-Star says big into MMA DFS. Yeah, MMA is a lot of fun for exactly that reason. Tennis is fun too. I like tennis for a similar reason. So, all right, let me see if we have any other questions here. I don't see any coming in. Looks like we are all caught up. So we'll go ahead and cap things off here today for the show. Appreciate everybody that hung out with me here. Good luck on this 13-game slate here tonight. Good luck in any other DFS endeavors that you have going on. And yeah, Andrew will be back tomorrow morning. Should be 11 o'clock Eastern, if I remember correctly. So the Saturday morning show, and then we'll be back again next week on Monday. So appreciate you guys. If you are, last thing before I note, if you stumbled upon this for the first time here, this is your first SaberSim Office Hour stream. First of all, welcome. It's good to have you. Second, we do have a free 5-day trial on our site, sabersim.com. So if any of the tools that we've been walking through today look cool or interesting, you want to dive into Contest Flashback and see how Awesomeo got a 3% win rate with 5 average dupes in his portfolio last night, or any of these other top players, how they were doing this, or you like the contest sims and the lead swap, like we talked about a ton of stuff today. 5 days totally free on our site, sabersim.com. You can come check it out. So in the meantime, I will see y'all later and take care. Thanks.